Happy New Year 2017! Hello world, and welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM on the internet, at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. We live stream the WBAI broadcast on WBAI.org. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. For the numerologists among us, 2017 is a prime number. 2017 has no positive divisors rather than one and itself. It will be 2027 when we will see the next year that is a prime number. What was the last time we had a year that was a prime number? The year was 2011. At the start of each new year, many pundits predict what new technologies we will see as emerging and significant for 2017. These are my picks, and you can catch me at the end of the year and let me know where I missed the mark. We will see the emergence of rise of biometric identification technology, from fingerprints to vein scanners, and reliable biometric technology has a potential to go a considerable way towards eradicating fraud. Next, look at artificial intelligence with wearable devices, where it is looking at wide amounts of data, culling that information and synthesizing it quickly, and you're now moving in a direction where AI is using this data aggregation and using it to make predictions. 2017 will be the year when, well, let's hope it's true, self-driving cars may become more practical for everyday traffic. I wouldn't call it new or emerging technology, but the onslaught of fake news will blur the lines in which we have a difficult time discerning what is real and what is fake and, or really, junk news. The Internet of Things has become mainstream, and by 2020, the number of connected devices will rise to 50 billion. $6 trillion will be invested in Internet of Things over the next 5 years. We need to address first the Internet of Security. The mobile workplace is going to be the new norm for 2017. Businesses have already accepted the trend of bring your own devices. 2017 will witness the companies devising strategies to make the most of this trend. And finally, the year of the cloud computing, which will continue to drive radical change across enterprise IT, and businesses will make even greater investments outside of their own data centers, particularly in so-called as-a-service computing. And now let's move on to Alfred Poor's second segment on wearable technology.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. As I record this, 2016 is just coming to an end, and 2017 is about to start. So I think it's a good time to pause and take a look ahead at 2017 and see what's in store for wearable technology in the coming year. I've got 5 different points that I want to talk about. Let's just run through them in order. First up is security. Now, last October, we had our wake-up call with the Mirai distributed denial of service attack on the internet. We discovered that we're just woefully inadequate in terms of security features in our connected devices. Fleets of baby cameras and other Internet of Things devices were commandeered by the hackers to attack the target websites that they were after. As it turns out, it's not just things like web cameras and thermostats that are vulnerable. Interesting report came out from a study done this past year where researchers discovered that pacemakers have connectivity, wireless connectivity that allows them to be controlled and reprogrammed. They found it was easy using just off-the-shelf components to interfere with and possibly even control those devices. So I think one of the big topics for 2017 is going to be a lot more discussion about security related to wearables and other technologies. We've done a very poor job of this. Hopefully it's not too late to lock the barn door. So you're going to see a lot more companies talking about their products and the security features that they've got built in. The second topic that I want to talk about is miniaturization. The whole reason that wearable technology has taken off like it has is that all the components have become so small, so inexpensive, and so effective that we're coming up with all kinds of new applications for them all the time. The fact is that these tiny little sensors and other components are already commodities, so it's really difficult for manufacturers to compete solely on cost. So where can they find a competitive advantage? Well, from what I see, I think the big areas where they can compete is one, by making their devices smaller, and two, requiring them to use less energy. That in turn requires less battery or other power source, which makes the overall device even smaller. That's going to be an important thing for the success of wearables going forward. And so I think the whole sensor and other component market is going to see additional shrinking of the size of devices and lowering their energy budget. As those components make their way through the design sequence, we'll find that we have smaller devices that have more sensors and last longer on a charge. The third topic I want to talk about, looking ahead to 2017, is the whole issue of how we're going to charge our wearable devices. A lot of people are talking about wireless charging, where you plop your device down on a charging pad of some sort. I just don't think that the efficiency's there. I don't think that the extra convenience versus plugging in is going to be there. So I really don't expect this to be a major factor in wearable devices going forward. However, I do see great potential for advancements in terms of energy harvesting. Finding energy in the environment around the person and the device, there's a lot of energy available from the mechanical energy, from motion. Think of the old-fashioned self-winding watch. But there's also heat, light, radio frequency waves. So there's a lot of different sources that could be used to scavenge energy in small quantities from the environment and use those to store and power the wearable device as needed. The fourth topic I want to talk about is the whole question of virtual reality and augmented reality devices. Virtual reality, VR, is getting lots of coverage. If you watch television at all, you saw lots of companies touting VR as the present to give this year. Frankly, I think that right now VR is a whole lot like a smartwatch. It's a solution in search of a problem. While they do have some application in terms of training and education, even some therapeutic uses and in medical applications, by and large, really all the VR devices are is a new way to isolate yourself. You're cut off from your surroundings even more so than you are with just plugging earbuds into your ears. And it's not a shared experience. It's something that you do by yourself. I think it's just going to be a tool for further social isolation, which I think is a problem. The rest of the iceberg is augmented reality, AR. And that is a significant application area that's already growing, especially in the enterprise area. Having glasses that technicians and other people can wear and access information while they're busy working on a problem, whether it's repairing a jet turbine or troubleshooting something else, this is a tremendous productivity booster. The fact that these have cameras in them means that a less qualified technician can be out in the field, but can be in direct contact with a more qualified expert back at the base who is supporting many technicians at once. And as the technicians get stuck, they can share what they're seeing with the person back at the base, who can diagnose things and give them suggestions and things to try and so forth. So I think AR is going to be the big winner. And I think we're going to see the scales start to tip in that direction even more in 2017. And I've saved the biggest topic for last. My fifth major topic for 2017 is that we're going to see enormous growth in health and medical applications of wearable technology. The bottom line is simple. This is where the money is. Smartwatches, virtual reality, fitness bands, those are all nice to have. For enthusiasts, it can be fun and in some cases be useful. But in order for wearable technology to really take off, there's going to have to be a clear and significant return on investment. In this case, one of the big areas where we stand to cut costs and become more efficient is in health and medical applications. I mean, the amount of money that we spend on diabetes in this country alone is enormous. If we can just do a better job of helping diabetes patients maintain their blood sugar levels, we'll eliminate a lot of the secondary complications, the circulation, amputations, blindness, those kinds of things, which end up costing an enormous amount. If we can avoid those complications, we'll save a ton. It's not just diabetes. It's also cardiac problems, heart failure, all kinds of chronic conditions that can be helped significantly by wearable technology. So I think we're going to see lots more use of wearable technology. Oh, and also we've got the new development where the FDA has decided not to enforce their hearing aid regulations. You don't need to get a prescription for a hearing aid or sign a waiver saying that you are declining the prescription. This is going to encourage all kinds of innovation in hearing assisting products. Presumably we'll end up with a lot lower cost at the same time. These are the kinds of things where we can save a lot of money, have a huge impact on the quality of life for people. We're already seeing signs of companies stepping in with new programs, new partnerships to advance these kinds of applications. So those are the 5 points that I'm going to be looking for in 2017 when it comes to the wearables industry. If you have ideas about what you think is going to happen in 2017 or what you'd like to see happen, please feel free to get in touch with me. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. And next is What's in the News? Cybersecurity misdirections. It was originally reported that the Russian hackers struck at a U.S. electrical grid. Well, that was the initial report. And it turns out that it was on a single laptop, not attached to the grid at all, and it was detected to have Grizzly Step virus on it, and it was GRIZZLY STEPPE. You could download that by doing a search on it. It's a 13-page PDF file, and it's a joint study that was released by the FBI and Homeland Security. The code associated this with Russian hacking operation, known as Grizzly Step, is found at a Vermont utility. The code which is associated with it, Department of Homeland Security's name for a Russian hacking operation, was detected on a laptop associated with a utility, but not attached to the grid, the utility said Friday. We acted quickly to scan all computers in our system for the malware signature, the utility said in a statement. We detected the malware in a single Burlington Electric Department laptop, not connected to our organization's grid system. We took immediate action to isolate the laptop and alerted federal officials of this finding. Federal officials shared the Grizzly Step code with executives earlier this week, and it was identified in the Vermont utility on Friday. According to the report, it's unclear when the code first entered the Vermont utility. The Department of Energy didn't respond to a request for comment on the report. The Department of Homeland Security couldn't be reached for a comment. The Russian embassy didn't respond to a request for a comment. On Thursday, the Obama administration sanctioned 9 entities and individuals and is expelling 35 Russian diplomats after federal investigators found Russia had interfered with the U.S. presidential elections by hacking and releasing emails associated with Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. Russia has denied any involvement in hacking directed at the U.S. election. Utilities and banks have been hacked before. Iranian hackers were indicted earlier this year for allegedly hacking a U.S. bank and a New York dam. Separately, parts of Ukraine's power grid were taken down in a hack, and some researchers have attributed to Russian activity. However, upon further investigation, we find that the Grizzly Step is not a Russian malicious. The Grizzly Step is originated from the Ukraine. A joint analysis report is a result of an analytic effort between the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This document provides technical details regarding the tools and infrastructure they claim used by Russian civilian and military intelligence services to compromise and exploit networks and endpoints associated with U.S. election, as well as a range of U.S. government agencies. The U.S. government is referring to this malicious cyber activity by RIS as Grizzly Step. Previously, the Joint Action Report have not attributed malicious cyber activity to specific countries or threat actors. However, public attribution of these activities to RIS is supported by technical indicators from the U.S. intelligence agencies and the DHS, FBI, the private sector, and other entities. This determination expands upon the joint statement released on October 7, 2016, from the Department of Homeland Security and the Director of National Intelligence on Election Security. Well, let's put all that aside and let's get to the details of it. This joint 13-page report released by the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, you can download it, read it, and what you'll find in it is that there's no reference to any election hacking. There's no reference to any Democratic National Committee hacking. They do refer to a hacking methodology, and that they have identified that the Russians have used or have been associated with this hacking tool. But this hacking tool was originated in the Ukraine. There's also no mention that it actually was used at all, and there is no direct correlation to any hacking of election results. The entire document addresses itself to the mechanics of how the virus works. Well, it seems that by association, what the current administration is doing is saying, well, now by this guilt by association, therefore the Russians have been hacking, and whatever happened in terms of the elections is related to what they may have done or have done. You know what? We don't know what it is. The problem I have with all of this is that we have all these agencies supposedly very skilled in cybersecurity, and we're doing things by, well, it's not even close. There's nothing scientific or putting your finger in the air and saying which way is the wind blowing. Can I say that they don't know what they're doing? Perhaps, but maybe perhaps we don't want them to know what we do know. And perhaps what we're doing is we're saying as little as possible and not try to tell them what we do know and what we might be able to do. But you know what? When you get to this level, as far as the American public is concerned, the whole thing doesn't make sense. We either have cybersecurity or we don't. We either have a joint report from all these services that, you know, when you come up with a piece of paper that tells you exactly how the virus works, how it's coded, and then your conclusion doesn't even match the precision of the report itself. We need something better than this. The FDA doesn't want your pacemaker to get hacked. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration finalizes cybersecurity guidelines and recommendations to protect connected medical devices. This is all part of the Internet of Things that is moving along very quickly. Whether it's cars or frying pans, more and more things are connected to the Internet of Things. While this adds a level to a convenience and control to everyday items, there's also an increased vulnerability for things to be hacked. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration recognizes this threat as a possibility for Internet-connected medical devices and advises manufacturers to take precautions now and how to handle future threats. In today's world of medical devices that are connected to a hospital network or even a patient's own Internet service at home, we see significant technological advances in patient care and at the same time an increase in the risk of cybersecurity breaches that could affect a device performance and functionality. To address this threat, the FDA recommends that manufacturers have processes to detect possible vulnerabilities within their device and develop a plan to release firmware updates to patch such weaknesses before a patient is harmed. The guidelines focus on action plans manufacturers can take after a medical product has been released. The FDA publishes a set of earlier guidelines in October of 2014 for ways manufacturers can design stronger cybersecurity protection into future medical devices. And the FDA promises to continue to advise manufacturers on cybersecurity moving forward. This is clearly not the end of what the FDA can and should do to address cybersecurity. They will continue to work with medical device stakeholders to monitor, identify, and address threats, and intend to adjust our guidelines or issue new guidelines as needed. The Amazon Echo Always Listening feature entangles it in a murder case. Police hope an Echo caught the sounds of a crime in Bentonville, Arkansas. Police would love to know whether an Amazon Echo picked up the sounds of a crime. Amazon isn't playing along, and as reported in the Washington Post, the investigation highlights the privacy issues around increasingly popular smart home products. The Amazon Echo in question was present in a home where a murder took place in November. Victor Collins was found dead in a hot tub after a social event that went late into the previous night. Police found the Echo among many other smart devices in the home, but the Echo is the only one that records what you say. Specifically, it's always listening to your wake-up command of Amazon or Alexa, which cues it to start recording. The recording includes a snippet of what you said before, as well as the command that follows. The device sends your command to cloud servers, where your speech is interpreted and the response is sent back through the device. According to Amazon Alexa, your commands are stored in the cloud and organized for easy review. You can delete recordings, and you can also turn off the Echo's microphone, though that obviously compromises the usefulness of the device. The trick in this case is whether anyone around the time of the murder issued a command to the Echo. Without that wake-up command, the device stores nothing. According to the Washington Post, Amazon was refusing to comply with a court order by law enforcement, and spokesman for Amazon declined to comment. Why does this matter? Amazon Echo and Google Home both sold well over the holidays, so chances are you or someone you know has a smart home assistant sitting on the coffee table. The conveniences they offer are impressive, if not addictive, but the data they collect brings up privacy issues. Maybe no one cares how many times you ask for country music or the weather, but the fact that the data is stored and could be accessed even by someone who just knows how to get into your account is important to understand. All New York City underground subway stations now have Wi-Fi. New York officials vowed that all of New York City underground subway stations would have Wi-Fi by the end of 2016, and they just met that goal, even if it's by the very last minute, and as of New Year's Eve, every one of the 279 subway stations now have internet access thanks to Transit Wireless. Wi-Fi's a long time in coming. The first station went online in 2011. But it is important if you either have spotty phone reception or Wi-Fi-only device that would only otherwise go dark. Full cellular coverage, however, will have to wait a little longer. It won't be ready until sometime in early 2017. And this won't help you much in the tunnels themselves, where there's still a real chance you'll go offline in between stops. Between this and Gigabyte Wi-Fi kiosks, though, it's almost trivially easy to get online in New York City. Has taken approximately 5 years to complete the rollout of this service, and as far as cellular coverage is concerned, that is expected to take place this year. Considering that the subway hosts a large number of commuters every morning and evening during the weekdays, this could be very important to those who are used to not having service during the morning and evening rush hour. Smartphone owners will see the option to connect to Transit Wireless Wi-Fi when they open up the Wi-Fi page on their device. Since New York City is the business capital of the world, maintaining connectivity is very important to those who work in the Big Apple. To that end, the city has converted some of the old school pay phones into free Wi-Fi kiosks running at 1 gigabits per second. 2017 promises to be the year that New York City subway riders can complete a mobile stock trade or shop online while waiting for their subway car to arrive at the station. Service is provided in sessions of 1 hour each. Once the hour expires, users can sign on again for another hour of free Wi-Fi. If you live in New York City or visiting Gotham right now, next time you are on a subway platform, you should turn on enable the Wi-Fi on your smartphone and enjoy connecting to a signal that is reaching you while you stand underneath a city's sidewalks. Why do we need to have the latest model? Some Google Nexus and Pixel devices are shutting down before the batteries drain. Smartphone battery life has been a struggle over the years, and we've just now starting to make some progress. There are phones you can get that will run reliably for more than a day, even with heavy usage. However, that's all for naught if you can't count on the device to actually keep working until the battery is depleted. This is a problem some owners of Nexus 6P and Pixel handsets are putting up with. Their phones are shutting down long before the batteries drain. The Nexus 6P was Google's flagship phone last year and is by far the more common device to suffer these symptoms. Owners report that phones will run fine, then they will abruptly shut down at between 10 and 60% remaining in the battery. Owners seem to be experiencing this earlier and more often in cold conditions. That part would be bad enough, but the affected phones won't start back up again until they have been plugged into power. So if you're out and about and your phone suffers from this defect, you're not going to have a phone until you find a charger. It's also worth noting that the Nexus 6P uses USB Type-C port, which is still fairly uncommon. That phone is getting long in the tooth, but the Pixel is brand new, so it's a little more concerning that a few Pixel owners are reporting similar bugs, usually occurring around 30% remaining charge. Since this issue is more common on Nexus 6P, that should give us more information about what's going on. There's a Google code thread with dozens of users contributing screenshots and experiencing with the bug. It sounds like the random shutdown started happening around the time Nougat rolled out to 6P. However, some people who have had the battery replaced, which required disassembling the phone, report that the issue had disappeared. This could indicate we're looking at a combination of software bug and a hardware fault. It's possible that some batteries are slightly out of spec, maybe they're over or under voltage. The connection to code supports this. The Nougat update may have changed something in the charging circuitry firmware that's triggering a fail-safe. Google is investigating the issue, but has marked it as a potential minor defect. Hawaii, which made the Nexus 6P for Google, is steering clear of the issue, directing everyone to Google. The Pixel shutdown issue isn't widespread enough for Google to comment on, but yet it may benefit if a firmware bug is found. On the other hand, iPhone 7 Plus owners report overheating and black screen camera issues. Some iPhone 7 Plus owners are reporting that camera issues include streaks of color on images, a completely black screen instead of an image preview, and a warning that the iPhone needs to cool down before the camera can be used, despite no sign of overheating. Some affected owners state that Apple replaced their iPhone, or in some cases, just the camera module. Reports of these issues can be found on social media sites and where they date back several weeks. The issues appear to be hardware related, as they persisted despite recent iOS updates. Affected users should take their iPhone to an Apple store for servicing or replacement. It doesn't appear any official workarounds have been provided. The marketing trap that we fall into is that a new model is always rushed into the market to replace something that is failing. We need far more reliability and reusability testing. We have to be much smarter consumers. The continuing evolution of the personal computer. There have been evolutionary changes in the personal computing platform. The floppy diskette is no longer in the standard configuration. The legacy VGA DisplayPort is fast giving away to either HDMI or micro HDMI. USB-C connecting ports are included with USB 2.0 connecting ports. The optical media drive is still available on high-end systems, but that too is fast becoming an endangered species. Unfortunately, on low-end budget systems, the RJ45 Ethernet port is no longer included. You would need an RJ45 Ethernet to USB adapter to do safe online banking. Quietly, there has been a shift of new systems moving from the traditional hard disk drive to solid-state drive. While there are merits to both solid-state drives and hard disk drives, the choice at this point is clear. The price advantage of HDD or hard disk drives, once held, is quickly slipping, and unless you have 1 terabyte or more of data to store, you should buy a system with a solid-state drive. They provide a noticeable bump in performance during boot-up times and data move-in, often clocking in at 5 times faster than the speed possible on a hard disk drive. It isn't difficult to find hard disk drive with several terabytes worth of storage. In contrast, solid-state drives don't hold quite as much, as they become prohibitively expensive over 2 terabytes and are more expensive along the way. When comparing storage capacity, hard disk drives currently beat out solid-state drives. Hard disk drives have been the standard for desktops and many laptops, as their large storage capacities mean one doesn't have to worry about running out of storage space too quickly. And their magnetic storage method means they have near-infinite read-write capabilities. For hard disk drives, the speed at which the platter is spinned helps determine the read-write times. When accessing a file, the read part of the read-write head notes the positioning of the magnetic section as it flies over the spinning platters. As long as the file being read was written sequentially, the hard disk drive will read it quickly. However, as a disk becomes crowded with data, it is easy for a file to be written across multiple sections. This is called fragmenting, and leads files taking longer to read. With solid-state drives, fragmentation is not an issue. Files can be written sporadically across the cells, and in fact are designed to do so, with little impact on read-write times, as each cell is accessed simultaneously. This easy, simultaneous access to each cell means that files are read at incredibly fast speeds, far faster than a hard disk drive can achieve, regardless of fragmentation. This faster read speed comes with a catch. Solid-state cells can wear out over time, and solid-state cells push electrons through a gate to set its state. This process wears on the cell, and over time reduces its performance time until the solid-state drive wears out. However, having said that, the time it would take in order for this to happen for most users is quite long, and would likely upgrade their solid-state drive earlier due to either obsolescence or desire for more storage space before a normal solid-state drive would fail. But it's still something to keep in mind. Solid-state drives are considered far more durable than hard disk drives due to lack of mechanical parts. The moving mechanism within a hard disk drive are susceptible to not only wear and tear over time, but to damage due to movement or forceful contact. If one were to drop a laptop with a hard disk drive, there is high likelihood that all those moving parts will collide, resulting in potential data loss and even destructive physical damage that could kill the hard disk drive outright. Solid-state drives have no moving parts, so while they hold the risk of potentially shorter lifespan, they can survive the rigors that we normally impose on portable devices and laptops. Another thing to be mindful of is the form factor of these drives. Hard disk drives are almost always 3.5 inches or 2.5 inches disk in diameter, while solid-state drives are spreading out into a variety of shapes and sizes. The most common is still the 2.5 inch drive. A slim plastic board with 2 plugs on one side, and newer desktops are fitted with a place to mount these specific drives, but they can also be mounted into 3.5 inch brackets with an adapter. While there are solid-state drives that can be mounted into PCIe slots, many are now compatible with a relatively new M.2 slot. This thin port found on the motherboard allows placement of the drive without cables and enables extremely high transfer speeds. As solid-state drives' prices drop to bargain prices, we're finding less reason to opt for a high disk drive option in the majority of systems. For $60, there are brand new 240 GB solid-state drives readily available, so it's $20 more than the cheapest 1 TB hard disk drive. For that $20, even casual users will notice a drastic improvement in boot-up time, data access, and general system snappiness. We expect new systems to include a solid-state drive or at least a hybrid drive, often a solid compromise. In addition to these options, there's also the choice of using a drive as an external storage device. There are drives manufactured specifically as external storage devices. However, virtually any drive that can be mounted in a PC can be inserted into an external housing kit and connected to a PC via USB. The device will function as a drive normally would, but can be carried with you so you can access your stored files with any PC or laptop. As the storage landscape shifts rapidly, solid-state drives are going to become much more prevalent than hard disk drives. Microsoft and Qualcomm announced a new reference design for a 32-bit Windows-based operating system laptop. Chromebooks have been selling well, especially in the education markets. These stripped-down notebooks basically provide access to the Internet via your Google account, and anything you can do on the web can be done on a Chromebook. Some are priced as low as slightly under $200, making them very attractive to the education market, though teachers might find them limited given their reliance on the web. Although there's not a lot of money to be made in this market, there are those who need a more full-featured device than their smartphone or tablet, but don't want to spend upwards of $1,000 for more features. Enter Chromebooks and low-cost Windows laptops. By the way, low-cost Windows laptops are somewhat competitive in price with Chromebooks, but the processors are very slow. At Shenzhen, China, a few weeks ago, Microsoft and Qualcomm announced a new reference design for a 32-bit Windows-based laptop that uses the Qualcomm Snapdragon 835 processors and run a full version of the 32-bit Windows 10 operating system. While one might be tempted to say this is a rehash of Windows RT, Microsoft has assured its customers this is a newly designed version of Windows 10 that will work seamlessly with all Windows 32-bit apps. Laptops with Qualcomm's 835 processor could be a promising alternative for thrifty shoppers who want a powerful PC. While we already see some basic Windows laptops on the market for as low as $299, the processor and features of these systems are at the bottom of the performance barrel. But what makes the Qualcomm Microsoft spec interesting is that Qualcomm's 835 processor is one of the most powerful mobile processors out there, giving low-end laptops more bang for the buck, so to speak, and laptops using their new specs could be a very promising alternative for thrifty shoppers who still want some oomph in their portable computer. Conceptually, a laptop using this spec could also become a solid alternative to Chromebooks, although at the moment, Microsoft has not stated how a laptop with these specs would be positioned. Either way, this new spec could evolve into an interesting new laptop option in 2017. Of course, the proof will be in the pudding. The announcement was just a spec, and we've yet to see any actual products based on this to understand how it's going to perform. But if Microsoft and Qualcomm can pull this off, they could revive the low-cost laptop market in a new year and give consumers another good option. Public service announcements. Westchester PC Users Group will be having a presentation on January the 5th, which is tomorrow, on Microsoft's new HoloLens offering. It will be held at the Keller Williams Realty. Meeting time is 7 p.m., 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on social media round robin on Friday, January the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Rockland PC User Group will be meeting next week, Tuesday, January the 10th at 7:15 p.m., and they meet at the Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. And finally, the New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on printer technology in 2017, Thursday, January the 12th, 7 p.m., at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 401. Photo ID is required. All these public service announcements are free admission, and they are open to the public. From the mailbag. A listener had an inquiry. He said, I recently purchased domain names from GoDaddy for my New Jersey-based public access. However, I now need a better-than-Wix or GoDaddy option for website building. Can you recommend something besides WordPress and the more common platforms? I'm operating on a shoestring budget for public access, so something simple just has to get up and running, but I need to be able to change the page as often as news cycle requires. Any tips would be greatly appreciated. Well, let me just say that Drupal and WordPress are most widely used by public access centers. WordPress is very easy to use. A WordPress primer and quick start guide by Telly Adlam, that's TELIADLAM, is recommended reading for a quick startup. WordPress is open source and is a website design tool. A listener had sent in a question about a Lenovo Mix, M-I-I-X. So before we get to the issue or the problem itself, what is a Lenovo Mix? It is a Windows tablet. The Lenovo Mix can be attached to a quick flip keyboard case that instantly converts it to a full-function laptop PC, perfect for on-the-go entertainment or productivity. And this is what she wrote. My Lenovo Mix keyboard is malfunctioning, not typing many keys including numbers, the P key, the backspace key, and the E key. Without the backup tablet keyboard, the entire unit is very much less useful, if not useless. I've spent a great deal of time on the phone with Lenovo customer support, and it is shocking how they literally don't have a solution for their own product. They don't sell a standalone replacement keyboard. They have all these replacement components that make up a keyboard, but I'm supposed to assemble a list of component parts somehow and present it to an authorized repair person. They told me to go to Best Buy and presumably pay them some fat fee, plus the cost of the parts, probably approaching the cost of the entire unit. Might you have any suggestion? I doubt there's an alternative, but I have to ask. And this was my response. I assume it's no longer under warranty, and if it's under warranty, hey, they gotta fix it. It is not a key problem. You may have a contact problem where the keyboard attaches to the screen system housing unit. Because the problem is typing a cluster of keys, the probable issue is the keyboard circuit board itself. In that case, you would need to replace the entire keyboard. The Lenovo parts database does not seem to include the keyboard available as a replacement by itself. The part itself is available, however, on eBay, which means they are pulled from used units. You would need to make necessary query as to which keyboard matches your Mix model. You have to weigh the cost of parts replacement versus buying a new unit. I hate to tell you this. You're probably better off buying a new unit. And I would have second thoughts about buying a Mix. I had asked Marty Winston to make up a list of preventive maintenance procedures computer user should be aware of, other than just changing a battery.
2017, yes, it's a prime number, but more than that, it's a happy new year, everybody. Hank wanted me to talk about all of the things we're supposed to do this year, and his list had one item on it, and that was change the battery in your smoke alarm. And I will tell you, don't check your battery, change your battery. You don't want to be dead because you decided a battery was still looking like it might be okay, and then the thing doesn't go off and bang, you're dead. You don't want to do that. While we're talking about batteries, there are a lot of other things around the house that have batteries, around your car that have batteries that you might not think of. Absolutely fine to check your car battery. Go to a service station, have them do that. Might just need a little water. Even the ones that are zero maintenance need water now and again. But if it's starting to age, you're going to want to know that before you're stuck somewhere, especially in the cold. Your garage door opener, your flashlights, especially the flashlight in the glove box that you never think about. You use walkie-talkies to keep in touch. If your cell phones aren't available, then those will need batteries. Motherboards have coin cells, those memory backup things on that hold the CMOS settings. If that motherboard's more than, 4 years old, the chances are that's something you want to replace. Be careful about bending the leads. You can make it hard to replace that battery. Portable radios. In the event of a power failure, a portable radio may be your best way to keep up with what the circumstances are, what the updates are, and what they're advising you do about it. And, well, it's not a battery. It is its own kind of charge. Double-check your car's tire air pressure. It's easy to ignore that. If there's a very, very slow loss over a long time, it's like it never happened until it's happened, and you're not getting where you want to go the way you want to get there. If you own a gun, clean it. This time of year, with humidity so low, double-check the humidity level where you store your ammo. A spark can make bad things happen. Your furnace filters. If you have any dirt at all on your furnace filter, you're putting too much load on the furnace, which can speed your need for replacement or repair, and you're using more energy than you need to use to make the house comfortable. You don't need a really, 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 really prohibitive filter on there. If you're not suffering from allergies, a nominal, inexpensive filter does everything you need that filter to do. And if you're not sure what to get, talk to the guy in the hardware store. Tell him nobody has allergies. Ask him what filter you can get away with. It's just fine for the HVAC system. I mentioned the car and power failures, and you should know about candles. Candles are good for light, sure, but a beeswax, specifically a beeswax candle, if you keep one in the car, in the event of being stranded somewhere in the cold, cold weather, a beeswax candle flame is exactly the amount of heat you need to fend off hypothermia, so keep one in the car. Speaking of hypothermia, you've seen, they're relatively inexpensive these days, the remote read thermometers, remote read temperature measuring guns. They're kind of like stubby gun shapes. Get one if you don't already have it, and go around the house and take a look at the temperatures of the walls, the windows, the doors, the registers, the floors. That will give you kind of a sense of where you might want to address either ventilation or insulation. Do that from the inside. Do it again from the outside if it's not impossible. And from the inside, you can see ways. It's really pretty obvious when you look at it. You can see ways to improve your comfort with doing fairly minor and cheap to free things just to keep air where you want it to be in terms of temperature and flow. It's not that hard. Your keyboard. Your computer screen. This is the time to shut the thing down for a few minutes and clean them out. Your mouse, too, for that matter. And if you use trackballs, you'd be amazed at the fuzz that grows in those things. So open that stuff up, blow it out. You know, canned air doesn't have to have that propellant in it. I've seen lovely canned air alternatives that have a fan in the can and blow a nice hard stream of air to clean things out. Don't be afraid to use toothpicks, if you're careful about not breaking them, to get at the little crud that goes in between keys on keyboards, especially notebooks. But clean that stuff out, and while you're at it, get yourself a disinfecting wipe, you know, like a Clorox or Mr. Clean or Lysol or one of those, and wipe them down. There are germs on those things, and normally they won't bother you, but what the heck, cleaning is cleaning. Why wait for spring, right? Dashlane is a utility that many of us use to keep track of our logins and passwords. Dashlane makes it a fairly simple project to go everywhere you want to be and update all of your passwords in about an hour. And that also can alert you to accounts you really don't want to keep open anymore. You could cancel those, close them, do other stuff. But Dashlane is your ally because it puts the entire index of all those things in one place. And depending on if you use the free version or a paid version, it can even let you maintain those passwords across multiple devices. Very, very handy, and I found it to be easy to recommend. Double check your backup drive. Make sure that backups really got made, and invest in one more drive. Get that in front of you in a second. You may have heard the phrase around here, backup, backup, backup. Well, let's go over a few. Back up your TV with an antenna. They're inexpensive. Antennas will get tons of stations in. And if there is a crisis in the winter, where cable goes out or satellite goes out, an antenna still lets you get the local stations where you're going to find the local news to tell you what to do about the local circumstances. So an antenna is a good thing you buy once. There's no subscription, and it keeps you on, you know, anytime you want, able to connect with local TV and get their advice or the advice they're relaying from local authorities. Back up all of your data, as you should all the time anyway, but back it all up once to that one extra drive. And that one extra drive is something you'll keep in a lockbox all year unless there's a disaster and your normal backup doesn't work. Back up your UPS by using its utility, as we said, to check its battery status. Back up your surge protection by checking for that idiot light or replacing the strips anyway. Back up your health with a little better posture by sliding your backup higher on the chair. And have a pal help you check to make sure your car's tail and backup lights are all working. And I will now pass my mic time back up to a better orator. This is the News Tips Bulletin Guy, Marty Winston, and again, happy Prime Number New Year.
Thank you, Marty. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time at WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. We wish everyone a very happy new year and a healthy new year. Stay safe, stay warm, until we meet again, same time, same station next week. Good night.